in a world full of straight people. Aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
Well, Matt, we record this between Coachella weekends, so I got music on the brain.
I mean, who doesn't? I've got Pride on the brain. I just came from Miami Beach Pride, which is strangely early in the year. But our guest today is going to be gracing the crowds at WeHo Pride in June, as the Lord intended, opening for Kylie Minogue.
Come on.
We are talking to a pop, rock, electronic singer-songwriter, also currently on tour, Z Machine. Hi.
Welcome.
Hello there. Thank you so much for having me. Oh, wait. So you were just at Miami Beach Pride. My friend Madison Rose just played there. I don't know if you saw her.
Oh, I didn't see anything. I have
fair enough.
I go every year, and yet I managed to see none of the offerings.
Okay. I only really knew what was going on because I saw her posting about it, but I think she was one of the headliners. Either way, I hope you have a time. And thank you.
I had a lovely time. Would have been lovelier if I saw her, I'm sure. But how are you feeling? You were nebulizing right when we
As I signed on to this, I had this steamer right in my face, which I just got off Amazon yesterday at the recommendation of a singer friend of mine. I've just been, I spent the last week and a half on tour. I was in New York, Toronto, and Chicago, which, and I don't usually sing this much at a time. So my vocal health regimen has kind of been on high alert.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, where are you right now?
Steam it. You got to moisturize
it. I'm currently in LA. Like we're sort of between legs right now. And then on Monday we fly to San Francisco. We fly back, and then we do the LA show at the Moroccan Lounge.
Nice.
Great.
And how is this tour going? How are the crowds?
Honestly, you know, when people ask you like, how are you doing? And a lot of the time the answer is like, I'm doing fine. And like, you don't really want to bum them out if you're not doing well. This is one of the first times in my life I feel like I can confidently say, honestly, it went great. Like I am awesome. So happy with the way it went. Like, it was me and my friend Bentley Robles. We're co-headlining this tour that we put together ourselves. And it's like the first time in like the 12 plus years of doing this that I've really felt like, oh, there are fans there. There are people outside of my mom and my close friends spreading the word of mouth, being annoying about it, who are finding these songs and learning them and singing them along with us and buying tickets and buying merch. It's a really crazy feeling. The imposter syndrome is real, but the love is even realer. So it's been really, really amazing.
That's fantastic. And you're playing WeHo Pride, which is essentially Coachella now.
I mean, it's my Coachella since I'm not actually going. It's
truly just a full-on music festival now. And
the
I guess
lineup
there's some
this
Pride
year
also.
Is crazy. It felt especially satisfying to manage to score a spot on that slot because I moved here to LA 6 years ago on Pride weekend. Oh, wow. I did not really know what I was doing. I didn't really know anybody. I was just in my head spiraling like, fuck, I think I'm gonna screw this up. Like I don't see this going anywhere. And I was like at Pride, seeing everybody do their thing, feeling very alone. And then 6 years, it's like I'm on the line. I don't know. Like, and I know that this isn't like, you know, the peak, you know, I've made it kind of moment, but it's a very satisfying full circle, and it felt really good, especially on the same day as Kylie. I mean, come on.
It's huge. Yeah. This isn't peak. It's a pretty good milestone.
It's definitely like a cornerstone kind of moment for sure.
This pivot that you're talking about, like finally kind of realizing that there are real fans and real mm-hmm. crowds and people who know the songs, to what do you attribute that change? Is it just sort of internal for you, or is it like a tangible change?
I mean, that's a big question. I feel like it's, you know, sort of the result of a lot of hard work on the craft, as well as just the right timing and luck and exposure. And like, if I'm going to be honest, like, I feel like I probably owe a lot of it to TikTok. I feel like if there's anyone listening to this who may have heard of me, chances are they probably found me on there, because I had always, you know, believed in what I was doing. But in this day and age, it's very hard to get, you know, ears on you, because there's just so many people out there trying to make it, which can make it both the best and the worst time to be an independent artist, because it's like anyone can put their music out there, but at the same time, everyone can put their music out there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I struck at just the right moment during the pandemic, when I, you know, had all the free time in the world. I finally had all the time that I didn't have when I was working three jobs to focus on the art. And there was like one video that caught on, audience grew by like 10 times. There was another video that caught on like 4 months after that, audience grew like five times more after that. And it just kind of, something snowballed at exactly the right moment. And then suddenly everyone started getting vaccinated and I could play shows again. And so I feel really lucky that I think this happened for me kind of when I needed it to. I think if it had happened at any point sooner, I may not have been ready. You know, and of course I would have, if it could have happened earlier, I would have loved that. But I think it was meant to happen when it happened. And the seeing the sort of exponential growth from then, and this is kind of a hard way to put it, but like the belief that I had in myself that I thought might have been delusional sort of pay off mm-hmm. after over a decade of doing this felt really, really nice.
Nice. Yeah. Feeling the world catch up.
I guess so. Nice, yeah. Feeling. Like I always believe that it's like, if you just give me a chance, I can do. And that's not to say that like, and now I've made it, but you know, I definitely feel like just the such a tangible difference, and like going to like another country that I've never been to, and having and selling out the venue and seeing people sing along is a bit of a mindfuck in the best way.
Sure.
It hits the G-spot.
So while you are, you know, driving around the country, what are you listening to?
Let's see. We rented a car and we drove from New York to Toronto to Chicago. So that was like 9 hours in between each. Yeah. We set up I forgot what it was called, but basically it's like a link to our Spotify where we could just add things to the queue. And we kept adding things as we drove, and we basically lasted like the full 9 hours. And I'm kind of forgetting what we added to it. I'm gonna go look at my liked songs literally as we speak.
Do the research in real time. Let's see.
I have some Erasure on here. I have some Celine Dion, Sabrina Carpenter, I have some Bee Gees, some Empress Of, I have the Weepies, I have Foxes, Whitesnake.
All right.
Yeah, it kind of goes all over. I didn't want to, you know, put anything on there that was like too much of a vibe killer. I got the Police. I got Michael Jackson, Mariah Carey, Hozier.
Okay.
Anything I wanted to share with them that might have been inspiring me in my writing. To be honest, like I feel like I've been listening to a lot less music lately, just because I've been so deeply entrenched in the writing and recording of my own stuff that sometimes you just need a break from that. So I've mostly been listening to like podcasts and audiobooks lately.
Okay. Talk to us. Which ones?
Let's see. I mean, to be totally honest, when I found out I was going to be on this one, I was actually very, very excited, because you guys were one that I was listening to.
Hey.
Year. Okay. So before I moved to LA and I was living in San Francisco, I had this sort of like office job at this dermatology clinic, and I would have my headphones kind of like discreetly in as I was doing my little busy work. And so you guys kept me a lot of company quite a few years back.
That's great to hear.
Before I was even really doing music. So there's a lot of that. I love Sibling Rivalry, which is, I think, Bob the Drag Queen and Monet Exchange. Uh-huh. Los Culturistas is great.
Fantastic.
Who else is here? I listen to Keep It a lot. Sloppy Seconds with Big Dipper and Meatball, which was like another sort of situation where I kind of went from being a fan to being a guest, which was kind of blew my mind at that point.
Huge.
And then old archived episodes of What's the Tea, which I think have not been, but with RuPaul and Michelle, which have not been deleted off of Spotify yet.
Uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. That is a well-rounded podcast carousel.
I try. And then there's also just like numerous Drag Race recap podcasts. So by the time the next episode comes out, I feel like I've been on the show.
Uh-huh.
Are you watching the current season?
I am. I feel like it was a bit of a slow burn to me to start with. But I feel like the top three is the correct top three. Yes. I feel like, I don't know if by the time this comes out, we may have the winner already.
And who do you think that'll be?
It's gone back and forth a few times for me. I think I am team Safira because I did know her back when I was in college in Boston. She was a New England queen at that point. So I would see her at like the first few gay clubs I went to. She would pop up a lot. I have a feeling Nymphia might win though. I'm getting a little bit of like a Sasha Velour, Violet Chachki edit from her, in the sense where it's like, she may not have the most wins, but she's never been in the bottom and the fans have really taken to her. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Something inside me is telling me that she might pull it off.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's back up a step. Let's talk about those early Boston clubs. What are we talking? Where did you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with the area.
Those were my first gay clubs.
Oh, Boston. Perfect. So the Machine in my name is actually, I've named myself after Machine Nightclub in Boston, which was like right by Fenway Park. Mm-hmm. It was my first gay club. It was, so I used to have a sort of bi-monthly, does that mean two times a month? Either way, two times a month.
I never can tell.
It's bi-weekly, bi-monthly. I'm not sure. Anyways, every couple weeks, let's just say every couple Fridays, I had a band that would have a residency at the 18 and up night at Machine Nightclub in Boston. And that was really where I just kind of learned to be a performer.
Yeah.
And it was also because I didn't have to be 21. So I started there when I was 20 and we did that for 3 years. The band name was Z, but we spelled it Z-H-E, which was, we thought it was being like really kind of weird and just different and like gender neutral, but really no one could pronounce it.
Yeah. Right.
So we were Z who played at Machine. And then when we all graduated and kind of went our separate ways, I wanted to sort of embody that, the spirit of the band. We basically played primarily like rocked out versions of top 40 songs at the time.
Uh-huh.
And we would do an hour set at the beginning of the night, because I think in order for them to maintain their, I guess, either liquor license or like ability to do an 18, an all ages night, they had to have a live act. Uh-huh. So we took that on. And I wanted to sort of carry on that spirit and energy. So I sort of rebranded myself as Z, but I spelled it Z-E-E so you could read it better.
Uh-huh.
And as time kind of went on and branding became a bit more of an issue, I realized that was a bit hard to Google. There were a lot of other artists who were doing a similar thing. So I needed to do something to differentiate myself. And I took Machine, stuck it on there, and just I'm trying to sort of continue that legacy with that, although Machine has since been torn down.
So. What were these top 40 hits of the time that you were playing?
I don't want to like age myself too much, but this was the golden era to me. I think everyone thinks their 21-year-old period was like the golden era of pop, but like back it was sort of like the heyday of like the Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Kesha, Rihanna, sort of EDM resurgence, sort of in like 2010, 2011.
Uh-huh.
Back when pop, the radio wasn't afraid to be loud.
Right.
I feel like it was very maximalist at the time, which really lent itself to a band who was trying to like hype the crowd up.
Yeah. So we're doing some We Found Love. We're doing
every week.
Yeah, great.
With that, we did Hold It Against Me by Britney. We did Firework. It was a lot of Dynamite by Tayo Cruz. Remember him?
Ooh,
I
sure.
know. What that talk about a song. A lot of like the Max Martin, Bonnie McKee penned gems.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Which actually Bonnie McKee is the perfect pop era. You're correct.
It is a great pop era.
It's not up for debate. really.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I'm glad you're on my side here. I'm glad it's not just my youth bias.
Yeah.
Coming up. I was much older than you, but I was still behaving as if I were 21.
Okay. It's okay. Yeah. Me too, so still sometimes.
Special. Yeah. Yeah.
you can't go wrong. Bonnie McKee is back. She has an album.
Oh, I know. Out. She is. And I actually just met her for the first time recently, a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who does a lot of writing sessions with her. And I did this. It's kind of like a TikTok duet, but she basically said, write a verse to my song. So I did that and she ended up resharing it. She followed me. And then I went to my friend's show that she was at and she was like, oh my God, I remember your verse. So
we're basically
best friends now.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm ready for her to have her moment. Boston wise, is Club mm-hmm. Cafe still around? Is that
I believe
still in
Club Cafe is still standing. Yes.
Fantastic.
It's one of the only ones from that time that had already been there that I think is still going, to my understanding from what I've heard.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A classic.
Where did you live there? What's your?
I went to school in Worcester.
Oh, and, nice. Okay.
And so, very small Catholic school. So to meet other gay people, I had to get on a Peter Pan bus and go into Boston.
Oh my God! What was that like? South Station or something like
South
that?
Station. That's South the one. Station. Yep.
I know her well.
And I would, I met a guy, a Harvard Med student, and we started dating, and he took me to Club Cafe, and I will never forget it.
That sounds sort of like a multiverse version of my story as well.
Yeah.
So
what's your story?
I ended up dating a frat boy at MIT.
Nice.
So, we love our Ivy League boys.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if that's what Ivy League means. Smart school boys.
Smart school boys, yeah. Did you grow up in the area?
No, I actually, my upbringing is a bit complicated. When someone asks me where I'm from, I don't really know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but I quickly moved to Madison. And then at age 9, I moved to Beijing, China.
Oh.
And I lived there for 9 years until I graduated high school because my dad got a job over there at this one school. But I also then, after leaving there, I moved to Boston. I was there for 4 years. I moved to New York for 1 year, San Francisco for 4. And then I've been in LA for about 6 now.
Uh-huh.
So I don't really feel as though my home is in any one of these. My family is still in San Francisco, but I was born in the Midwest. I don't really feel a lot of connection there. I've lived the longest in China, but I definitely don't feel very connected there anymore. So I just kind of say I'm from wherever you want me to be.
I see.
Yeah.
And it actually is true in your case. Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like normally, I don't know, my rule of thumb is where you went to high school seems like a good, easy show. But for you, it would be strange if you simply
said, it would
said,
be weird to say
China.
Like I'm from China. I don't really necessarily want to claim that, even though those were some pretty formative years.
Yeah.
I haven't been back since 2010, and my grasp of the language has faded significantly.
Yeah.
I want to know a little about your like formative music experiences as a kid, not to age you, and you're clearly a baby anyway, but like what was your first concert?
You're very sweet. My first concert, I can't remember if it was the summer of 2003, and it was either Kelly Clarkson promoting her first album.
Ooh.
Or Carlos Santana at Summerfest in Milwaukee.
Oh, wow.
So it was one of the two. And they were both the same summer. I don't remember which one came first, but I would say that's quite the contrast, but also a pretty good example of my early influences, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, but when you're a kid, I mean, they're different artists, but just the excitement and spectacle of live music when you're young and into it is just... It's overwhelming.
Oh, completely. Especially because I was just starting to learn how to like play in bands and stuff. Like the music program at the high school, the middle school and the high school I went to back in Beijing at this international school, it was unlike anything I've ever experienced or heard about in the US. Like it was this guy from the UK who had this full room full of like band. I don't mean like orchestra band, like he had like electric guitars and drum sets and stuff. And there was an after school program that was basically like rock school. And I think he kind of saw early on that I took to it a little more naturally than some of the other people there in the program. And so I kind of started on drums and then I started playing bass because I wanted to like sing a little bit and be more upfront without having to learn how to the complexities of guitar. And then I started wanting to learn guitar because I heard, you know, Comfortably Numb by Pink Floyd, and I had to learn that. And then having played all those and then going to see a show like the Santana show and seeing like a 15 piece band and just trying to like hear each part and like be like, oh, is he going to do the solo like he does on the record? Oh, who's going to be singing that song? Because his albums are all features. It was a really cool, I think, first live band experience or live concert experience.
Yeah. What was, I mean, was there a dating life for you in high school?
Not that I would take all too seriously. Mm-hmm. I feel like my coming out process, so to speak, was very gradual and not particularly interesting, I don't think. Like, I almost feel like I kind of have survivor's guilt for my coming out process, just because, you know, I know it can be a very, for a lot of people, it can be very traumatic. It can be a very emotional, potentially like hurtful time or thing to do. But like, I kind of found myself slowly, I don't want to say turning gay. That's totally the wrong word. But like, I remember a period of time where like I had girlfriends and I was very attracted to these girlfriends and I was very in love with them. And then as I kind of went through high school, I kind of lost interest in those and started sort of discovering feelings across the gender spectrum. And by the time I graduated, I was like, I don't think I'm straight anymore. And I was lucky enough to have grown up in a household. And I also found out that this was uncommon, where my parents raised me with no religious influence whatsoever. There was no point at any time growing up where they made me feel like I had to hide who I was. And I feel very, very, very lucky for that. So any trauma I inflict on myself is all just me. It wasn't them. But like, I came out to my mom in like an email in freshman year of college, I think on coming out day. It was so cliche. October 11th, 2000.
Glad to see someone's observing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think, you know, gotta, you know, give the youth something.
Sure.
But I had a few girlfriends here and there, but nothing particularly long-term, nothing that was really that deep. It was just sort of like, it's what you do when you like somebody. But I didn't really start dating or becoming an emotionally mature, some would argue I'm still not an emotionally mature person, until after I moved back to the US for college.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't really have any awareness of myself as a queer person until after I left Beijing. And I had a lot of catch up to play.
Sure. I mean, listen, we're all still catching up. I mean, it feels like you are unapologetically queer on stage in your work. Was there ever a point that you were pressured to be more palatable to straight fans?
There have been a few times where would it be boring if I said no? I was encouraged to be, and it just kind of felt like a no-brainer. It's like, well, I can't do that. And it's not, and it wasn't even like a rebellious, like, no, you can't tame me. Like, I can't be contained in this box. It was just sort of like, that feels boring to me. It feels dishonest. I'm not a good liar like that. And I know that it would kill me inside. So the few times I have been either approached by like some sort of management figure who encouraged me to maybe go more of like a, maybe like an Ed Sheeran type of route. And like, no shade to Ed Sheeran, very talented guy, but like, that's not really what I do. But the thing is, I'm also not like trying hard to be like excessively gay or queer. I think I am just being myself. And if that ends up being really, really gay, then you know what? So be it. That's just all I know how to do is just like sing my mind. And it seems as though it's connecting with the people it needs to connect to. And I think, you know, sure, maybe I didn't have the emotional like lifetime movie coming out story experience that a lot of people I know have had. But in a way, I feel like maybe that can be an example of what being unabashedly and yourself could turn out like. I try to make the music I make and the things I talk about and sing about just be like a celebration of being yourself and being queer. And because like, honestly, if I could choose it, I would choose being gay again. So, and I would love for any queer person to know what that feels like, I guess.
Right. You know, it's funny. We had Darren Hayes on recently.
I was just listening to you guys actually.
He talked about making his first solo video, mm-hmm. and the record label being like, you know, you got to mm-hmm. butch it up and whatever. Yeah. You know, that was sort of in your early experience of music that was happening, and mm-hmm. now you are where you are. What changed? Like, what do you think it is that changed the industry so that a young artist like yourself is not being pressured as hard to?
I mean, I think it probably took a lot of people having to say, like, push through those experiences and like mm-hmm. either say yes or like say no to that kind of stuff. You know, I'm trying to think of like specific moments that might have happened. I feel like it was 2009. I think the year 2009, mm-hmm. I think was the gay revolution in a way. I feel like I think I'm oversimplifying it, but like in my memory, I remember that being a year that like suddenly it was like we had a new president. We had a Democratic president. Uh-huh. Prop 8 had happened. Drag Race debuted. Glee premiered. Modern Family premiered. Adam Lambert was on American Idol. I just think something in the air in pop culture, it felt like it shifted sometime around that year. And I don't know if it was necessarily one thing in particular. I think, you know, that we had just kind of built up to a head. And oppression of queer culture in media, and you know, people, gay people, sort of being like the butt of the joke in a lot of things, and it being okay to, you know, the Hillary Duff ad using gay is stupid had been acceptable for too long, and I feel like people were just kind of sick of it, and everyone just started putting it right on the mainstream, and what do you know, people liked it because we've always been, you know, the definers of culture.
Sure.
So I think for some reason I never actually thought of this really specifically, but literally just now I'm like, I think it was that year where all these things just kind of happened at once and we had no choice but to accept it.
You know what? You made a very strong case for 2009 as the gay revolutionary year.
Yeah. You know, I the more I think about it, I'm like, wow. But I'm wondering if that also is just if my experience, well, that was when I started college and when I started being gay, if that has any influence mm-hmm. on it. But at the same time, you know, I think I got the data to back it.
Yeah, I think you've built a very strong case. Mm-hmm. When was the Fame? What year did the Fame come out?
That was 2008,
2009. See? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it technically came out at the end of 2008, but Just Dance and Poker Face were hit number one in the early quarters of 2009. Don't get me started on Gaga stats. I could go on forever.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. What are your feelings on Folie à Deux?
Oh, I'm ready. I'm so ready. I'm very excited by the trailer. My only worries on that are that she's been posting a lot of cryptic little stories and comments sort of alluding to the fact that she's recording new music. And I've heard murmurings from friends within the industry that like about like the sound and the vibe of what she's recording. And I'm just like, crap, we're not going to get this for another year because she's about to go headfirst into this movie promo cycle. So unless she drops it right now, which I do not see happening, we're probably going to have to wait another year for this goddamn album. And I'm a little impatient, but she is my girl and I will be here waiting.
This is a big pop girl year though. I can see her dropping something seismic in the middle.
You are right about that. Everyone and their mom is dropping an album. Or maybe it's smart to wait because the field is so crowded.
Maybe.
Probably smart to wait. Yeah. I do want to believe that it's this summer because then she still has a whole summer to get through before the fall. October is when the movie comes out. Yeah.
I would love that. It's just, you know, she'd probably have to start the promo cycle in like, it's coming out in October, like late August, September. Cause she knows she's got to get her 99 people in the room thing going on. So who knows? I mean, I will take it whenever she gives it to us. I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to get anything new, especially since she's probably going to have to be promoting the music from the movie.
Right.
From which she's probably written an original song because that's what they do. You got to add that original song so you can get that Oscar nomination.
Maybe. Now, is it 100% confirmed that it's going to be a musical?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They've confirmed that there's going to be like, it's like a jukebox musical. Okay. I was getting Moulin Rouge vibes from it, sort of.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But a little darker.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Beyond Gaga into this pop girl year.
Yeah.
What are we liking the new Beyonce? Are we excited about the new Dua Lipa? What where do our sympathies lie with
the pop girls? I think I mean, obviously Beyonce wasn't gonna give us anything but like the utmost quality.
Yeah.
It is a little bit long for me. It's not like an easy listen, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. I feel like Dua Lipa is delivering really solid pop music, but I feel like the general consensus around whatever she's doing right now is that this isn't really the redefining sound that she was hyping herself up to be. Not that I think all of the songs she's put out have been good, but they've all kind of been like variations on a theme. None of them have really felt like this. Although I will never skip Houdini when it comes on.
Yeah.
But artists love to say what vibe they're going for. They love to say, I'm doing a disco album, and then it sounds nothing like disco. They love to drop a house single, and then the rest of the album isn't house. Like we got that with Break My Soul. We got that with Yes, and the rest of the album sounded completely different. So who knows? Maybe the remaining tracks on the Dua Lipa project are a complete 180 from the Kevin Parker produced ones we've been getting.
Yeah.
But honestly, I think my favorite of the pop girl albums so far has been Ariana.
Really?
Yeah, this might be not controversial, but like I really like a concise album. Like I love like a 10-track, 40-minute album.
Sure.
Because I feel like it leaves a little bit less room for, hopefully less room for filler. And it's just a very satisfying number. But like a 10 or 11 song album, love that. So I was a little bit daunted by the 27 tracks on Cowboy Carter. Granted, I feel like she fully came through, but I was like, Jesus, how's she gonna pull this off?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I really gravitated towards, the flow of the Ariana album. I think her voice sounds better than ever, and I really kind of feel like her perspective as an artist was more fleshed out than it ever had been.
Yeah.
I gotta say, but obviously Beyonce can do no wrong. I would never say a bad word about her. Obviously, Dolly can do no wrong, but never say a bad word about her. We're thrilled to hear Beyonce's Jolene, all of that. The voice memo from Dolly leading into Jolene, where she says, like, hey,
hey, honey, Dolly, it's Dolly P.
Didn't you kind of feel like, was that the best take that we could? Okay, it's just like, it's a little hard to understand her. And I would never slander Dolly in any planet. I don't know. I guess when she fires off a voice memo, you just take what you get and you don't ask. You don't get a note.
Yeah. I'm going to have to give that another listen with this perspective and see what you're talking about. You may have a point there.
Yeah. The whole thing does feel a little perfunctory somehow. You know,
I feel like this was recorded. I mean, we don't know exactly, but the story out there is that it was recorded not long after Lemonade,
right?
Or it was recorded before Renaissance. So I feel like something about something
we
about
need the
that
nebulizer.
It's dislodging everything in there a little too well. Ugh, that's gross. I can kind of feel that timeline there. So it might feel like it feels like a little off in that sense. But also, I feel like with the pandemic coming when it did, I feel like dropping Cowboy Carter then would have felt a little strange. And I feel like she knew that we needed to dance. She knew we needed something to move to. And I think that was the right move. But like, all those vinyls were printed before she had the chance to add those new songs on it. So I feel like that was kind of a little glimpse on what she had originally intended.
Yeah. I want the visuals. I'm ready for the visuals.
I do too. But you know, my sort of thoughts on all that is that we spent like 2 years coming up with theories about when the Renaissance visuals were coming, and we never got them. I feel like we have placed this expectation on her because she has set the bar for music visuals so high twice in a row now. She's given us two full albums, two full films. And so now we're just like, oh, that's just what she does now.
Yeah.
And I think that she just was like, honestly, I'm not feeling these. Because I know people who were working on them.
Yeah.
And I knew people who was like, I've seen some of them. I've seen Virgo's Groove. They are there. They were filmed. And she's moved on. And I think it's giving Prince, honestly.
Yeah.
She's got a vault of stuff that's fully finished. We will just never see.
Wow. Oh, God, I want to go there. I want a vacation there so badly.
Lock me in there.
Oh, mercy.
You're open about being clean and sober for years. And I'm curious, I mean, obviously only in so much as you're comfortable sharing, but like what was the relationship between drugs and music for you? And as you've untangled that in recovery, what role does sobriety play in your art now?
Well, I mean, the relationship between, you know, the drugs and music is that there really can only be one or the other for me. Or that's what it became anyway. Like, it got to a point in, like, you know, I got to college, I'm in music school, everyone's, you know, rock and roll, fucking drinking and smoking. And so I kind of started out with people around me who were all, you know, doing as much as I was. As time went on and I moved out of Boston, it became pretty clear that, like, I wasn't in control of the steering wheel of this thing, of what was going on in my head. And it's the type of thing where if you don't have, you know, the disease of addiction, it's very hard to kind of explain that feeling, because it's, if something is destroying your life, like, obviously you need to stop that. And explaining to someone who doesn't have that uncontrollable craving why you can't stop is very difficult to convey. But it got to a point where it was sort of like, I thought that, you know, the drugs were putting my mind in places that I couldn't go sober, but like, I was spending no time creating. And when I was trying to create, it wasn't good. So honestly, getting sober was what saved my music. You know, I had, the moment I got sober was when every song that you hear, every song but one, I did record one before all that, but everything after that was after I had cleaned up. And there was a point where I, you know, took a break. When I moved to LA, I took a couple years to be California sober, because I was doing some pretty hard stuff before that, that made it very hard to focus or sleep. And in that time, you know, I was still creating, but it got to a point, even when I was just smoking weed again, where it just took me to a really dark place where it just controlled my life. And when you are in the grips of addiction, it doesn't want you doing anything else. And I'm very grateful that I managed to have these moments. I sort of call them, you know, God shots, where you have a moment of clarity and you go for it before, you know, the disease gets to you. And I've got about, well, I don't want to get into all that, but I think since that has happened has when it was the point where my entire career has just like opened back up. So like, this was like right before the pandemic happened, and since then, like, my life has just completely turned around in terms of what I've been able to create and achieve, and with just being a creative, not to mention just like the tangible achievements. I can't imagine going back and doing the things I was doing before with the life I have right now. Like I can barely handle what's going on sober right now. Like the thought of being a drug addict again is so exhausting. And thank God, because I know a lot of people who do not have that same mindset, and I'm really, really grateful for that, and grateful for every day I have.
Oh my God. And see, we are so grateful for you.
Thank you.
Sea Machine.
Thank you so much.
So how are you getting ready for the big festival?
How am I getting ready? I have four more dates on the tour, which we'll be doing. We'll be doing San Francisco, LA, and then we're flying to London and Manchester, which I'm very excited about. But in that time, I'm also putting together the finishing touches on the next EP I'm trying to drop, which it's been 6 years since the last one. I've basically just been putting out song after song after song, just on their own. And I wanted to kind of put out a more cohesive body of work, which isn't really a muscle I've flexed in a while. But I found that these last few shows I did, it was like vocal boot camp. It was like performance, like not masterclass, but like it was just like I had to get my ass in gear. And I feel like so much, I was very nervous going into it. And now I just feel so ready. And in doing this, I'm kind of figuring out what songs get the best reaction from the crowd, what feels best vocally, what keys I should take this all in, what the best flow of songs could be. Because I'm going a little earlier in the day. I'm still going to say I'm opening for Kylie, but I am going a little earlier in the day. So it's a 20-minute set. It has to be all killer. Like, this is not a time to, like, I feel like this might not be the time to debut something risky. But I feel like these tour shows are the time to hone in on that and what works. And I feel like by the time that comes, I'm going to be like top of my game. Like, this is very much something I've worked towards for a long time. I can't fuck it up in front of Kylie, no. Or the rest of LA. And it's just going to be a good time. I'm on the lineup with another, with Vincent, who was a classmate of mine at Berkeley back like 13 years ago. So, and to have both of us kind of on that lineup feels very, very cool and full circle.
That's exciting.
Yeah, no, I'm
what
sorry.
Day?
This
what
is
day
gonna be on June 2nd. I think that's a Sunday.
Okay.
Probably the day before us is Janelle Monae is the headliner. So really it can't go wrong with either day.
No, that's a killer festival.
You gotta go all weekend long.
Yeah, tickets.
It's the only way to do it.
That full weekend pass.
Yeah.
Sea Machine, exactly. Thank you so much.
Oh my God, thank you so much. It's really, when I found out I was going to be on the show, I like did a gay gasp on that. So it's really been an honor to be here. Thank you both so much.
So did we.
It's been an honor to have you.
That is our show. Please do give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Instagram at HomophiliaPod. Homophilia is a World of Wonder production, music by Ben Wise. Our executive producer is Renee Colvert. Our associate producer is Jess Walensky, and our audio engineer is Justin Mattson. Many thanks to Michael Pressman and everyone at World of Wonder.